Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moyne and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. Since we've recorded the last couple episodes, there have been about 18 new entrants in the new most important debate in legal theory, the Moyne-Witt debates. How's it going?
Well, you know, I laughed, I cried. You know, I think that we've fought ourselves to a truce at this point. But, you know, in the aftermath, I've been pondering it, and I realized that, you know, maybe the most important topic was left out, which is, of course, urban economics.
That is the most important topic. And fortunately, we have with us literally the best person possible to talk about urban economics, maybe the leading urban economist of our age, Ed Glaser. He's talking about his new book, Survival of the City. Let's get to it. Welcome to Digging a Hole. We're so happy to have with us one of the nation's leading economists discussing his important new book. Edward Glaser is the Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor of Economics at Harvard University and is the chair of the Economics Department. He's the author of so many papers, I just can barely count them, and several books, including Triumph of the City, which we're going to actually come back to in a second. Tyler Cowen, the economist and podcaster and blogger, recently described Ed as the most important urban economist ever. And while Ed demurred on this thing, I'm not going to personally argue with Tyler on that front. And on a personal note, his work was remarkably influential on me, and it's one of the reasons I study the law and economics of cities and land use. We're going to be talking about Ed's terrific new book with David Kotler, Survival of the City, which discusses the health in cities and the economic and social health of cities. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you so much for having me on, David. It's great to see you.
Thanks for joining us. I just wanted to open with a question just to kind of ask why you wrote the book and give us a sense of where it sits in relation to the Triumph of the City. This book, when I read it, it doesn't seem like we're in as triumphant a moment as, you know, all those years ago. And I'm just curious, you know, is it just the pandemic, or did broader things in the world change in big ways to kind of make this a kind of more dicey kind of moment for urban life than it, you know, at the end of the, you know, kind of millennia that led to the triumph only 10 years ago?
So there's a sort of long run and short run question. So I remain as optimistic about the role of cities in the future of mankind as I did 10 years ago. Right. None of that has changed. Humanity is an urban species, and that will continue. But there's no question that the short run is much more fraught. And the pragmatic consensus that had emerged in cities after the very difficult years of the 1970s and 1980s has largely unraveled. That consensus enabled cities to get through the Twin Towers bombings 20 years ago with relative equanimity. The impact of a natural disaster or a terrorist attack is always mediated by the strength of civil society beforehand. And for maybe a decade before the COVID pandemic struck, various forms of fractures in urban life were beginning to appear. Unhappiness about gentrification, unhappiness about policing, unhappiness about high housing prices, unhappiness about inequality. And I believe that that left us in a weaker position facing this sort of massive hit on urban life. I mean, in some sense, we've had a blessed century since the influenza pandemic of 1918-1919 that has led us to forget just how dangerous cities can be in their ability to spread disease. And we have certainly remembered that fact now full on in the last year.
So that leads perfectly into the question I wanted to ask you, which is, first of all, the book was great. As I read it, your diagnosis of the future of American cities is that they can survive pandemics and working from home, but perhaps they can't survive themselves or in their own political contradictions. While the kind of inherent benefits of urbanness will drive people to take great risks, getting sick, and will cause them to congregate in offices instead of on Zoom calls, the problem of political insiders, homeowners who restrict construction, police unions that protect bad cops, entrenched political school systems, is in many ways they're like the great risk. Should we think of the power of insiders in cities to be an inevitable urban disease, just like pandemics over time? What is your study of history, of the history of cities from the Ur Valley to Silicon Valley? Tell us about how cities can overcome their worst enemy, themselves.
So there is a reasonable track record of urban reform movements. I mean, chapter three of the book, which tells about how cities fought so hard for their health in the 19th century, which in a sense I see as like a hinge of history in which governments for the first time stopped being primarily agents of death, which is pretty much the overwhelming thing that governments did prior to 1800 was to kill. And they turned into actually agents of life by building sewers and by building aqueducts, all of which took major ground up reform movements. So I think it is possible, but it's not easy. I mean, this is, you know, the story that Manker Olson told in Rise and Decline of Nations, and he certainly saw it as inevitable. I don't, but I am well aware of just how hard it is to remove entrenched insiders and how powerful the urge is when faced with one set of insiders to say, oh, they have theirs, let me get mine. Let me create an alternative pact of insiders to grab, which is the last thing that we need. We need instead to sort of to stop treating our cities as a zero-sum game and instead to, you know, make them places for outsiders, which is what they were always meant to be.
So Olson was focused on interest groups at the national level. How is your understanding of reform informed by the fact that we're talking about subnational governments, which people can leave, which makes them different from countries, and that people don't pay that much attention to the politics of, unlike countries?
Absolutely, right? So there's more competition among cities, which is traditionally why, you know, even if New York City felt like it became controlled by insiders in the 1970s, and that's certainly a way of reading, you know, Ken Auletta's The Streets Were Paved with Gold, is it's a tale of how insiders captured New York. But even when that happened, you know, there was a Houston, there was a Dallas, there was Atlanta, there were all these free places that were open for business that welcome in outsiders. So the competition helped. And then it helped New York. I mean, New York became a little bit more open after that. And you have this, you know, this saving thing about city government, which is so many of the public tasks are fundamentally non-ideological, right? The old line that there's no Republican or Democratic way to clean a sewer. However, the past year, given how ideological fighting a pandemic has become, where I would have thought there's no, you know, Republican or Democratic way to handle vaccines, apparently now there is. So I'm perhaps losing a bit of faith in the pragmatic nature of urban government.
So, I mean, one of the great things about the book I found is that you return to kind of a number of longer term stories about cities, even though, as you said, you're kind of you're noting now a kind of decade, kind of phase of disruption, and then of course the year or two of pandemic. I wanted to ask about kind of how you foresee the future of work in the city. Not just kind of the more short-term things about the return of work after the pandemic, but about your skepticism about post-work. I loved the, you know, engagement with, you know, John Maynard Keynes and his great essay on economic possibilities for our grandchildren. And I would think, you know, and I don't remember him mentioning cities in the essay, but, you know, I'm sure he would have wanted us not to work in Bloomsbury rather than out in the country. But you're still skeptical because, I mean, it sounds like you think people just won't accept an end to work, even if the economics allow it. Why not? And why can't we imagine cities as like fundamentally places of leisure, not just for the rich, but for the rest?
So Keynes's vision, which was, you know, akin to a life of the British upper classes for ordinary people, is so culturally foreign to most of America that it's just hard to imagine that working, right? I mean, for so many of us, right, our sense of self comes from the work that we do. Our sense of social connection comes from the friends that we make at work. And this is where, you know, happiness and life satisfaction comes from. It is, you know, who are your friends and do you feel like you're spending your life in a worthwhile way? It's just hard to see people, you know, moving to a world in which a life of overwhelming pleasure seeking serves the same function. And certainly the data on, you know, the jobless suggest their lives are miserable. I mean, jobless men in particular. Jobless women are actually much more likely to be actually doing something productive and feeling good about themselves. Jobless men are just spending huge amounts of time watching television and feeling crappy. So I'm just very skeptical about that. In terms of the long run, I certainly, prior to the pandemic, was optimistic that at least if they were unleashed, urban entrepreneurs would figure out good things to do in the service sector in cities, right? You know, this sort of vast, urban service economy, which, you know, at the national level, that's 32 million Americans in 2019 who are laboring in leisure, hospitality, and retail trade. I see nothing that prevents that industry from changing and morphing into something new and exciting, always in cities. I'm not at all sure what that means for West Virginia, right? It's much harder to imagine what the what those service sector entrepreneurs are going to do in lower density parts of America.
So that's great, because that leads up to exactly where I wanted to put push you a little bit. In the years leading up to the pandemic, you started to focus heavily on a problem that's not wasn't associated with your previous work on cities, which was the problems of declining left behind areas, your West Virginias. In some of your work, you kind of inched towards some ideas that one might call place-based policies after being opponents of them. I actually think you became a bit of a squish on these things, a little bit. But in this book, you also kind of go on a different line in your research, and you talk about your kind of important work on why information technology, at least pre-2020, was actually a force for urbanization. Increased returns to skills. You could run big global enterprises from an office in downtown Palo Alto. And so you, in this book, you use that work to say that even if Zoom pushes some people away from downtowns in search of like cheaper housing, many will attempt to get access the wage growth that is very much enabled by information technology in cities, that kind of returns the skills associated with the kind of high-tech economy. I was wondering if you could combine these thoughts a little bit and tell us, what do you think the effects of kind of Zoom and work from home on the Clevelands and West Virginias of the world? I mean, people are still going to move to New York, but who could decide to live anywhere is going to live somewhere where there's something called the Lake Snow effect? Another story people tell, and kind of think of like Adam Ozimek or people, talk about like work from home is going to be a panacea for these areas because they're low cost and people will move out. I lean towards this former story, which is that like, you know, the super high people, high income people will still congregate in high income areas. And this, the people, the cities that are going to be the worst off are going to be the places that are, you can leave and you'd like to leave if you want to. But I'm wondering on your take, like, what do you think the effect of technology is going to be on geographic inequality?
So I'm with you, David. I think like the there's very little that is going to, you know, that seems to be left protecting the downtowns of Cleveland or the downtowns of Buffalo, right? And in terms of, let's say, once we get past the disease, you know, commercial prices may decline in New York or Chicago, but those office buildings are going to get filled up again. They're just too valuable, right? So they're not going to be $80 a square foot to rent. They're going to be $60 a square foot to rent, but they'll still get rented. But if you're starting at $20 a square foot, right, you can easily hollow out. And that, of course, can spiral out because, you know, once you have people who aren't going into the offices, then that kills off the service sector jobs. And so the downtowns of the Clevelands and the Buffaloes seem likely to be hit. Now, are there suburban areas likely to then boom because of people working from home there? That also seems quite unlikely to me, right? You know, the people who are working from home are overwhelmingly going to be highly skilled people, right? And that's sort of an important part of the work from home revolution, right? So if you go back to May 2020, which was the, you know, the high point of work from home, 68.9% of Americans with advanced degrees were working from home, 5% of people who are high school dropouts were working from home, 15% of people who had high school degrees but no college degrees were working from home. This is a very, you know, skill-connected thing. And so you want to ask yourself, where do people with advanced degrees want to be? And it's hard for me to imagine that what they want to be is in you know, a suburban declining Rust Belt town, which, you know, when they have all of America, which most of America, apart from the coast, is pretty inexpensive, right? It's not like we have an absence of cheap space. So what you want to look at is places that attracted highly skilled people beforehand, that had relatively good amenities, and perhaps that also were able to deliver inexpensive housing. But, you know, if you ask me, I think, you know, college towns may well be in for a boom. Places that are, you know, high amenities, low density areas that, you know, Vail, Boulder, you know, nice places that people really wanted to live in, those high amenity places, those are likely to be the winners. Now, I personally, like, am always in love with the Buffaloes and Detroits and their grandeur. But I think we have to look historically, they haven't been great magnets for, you know, highly skilled graduates moving there. And so, you know, despite the fact that I'm always rooting for the Detroits, Clevelands, Buffaloes of this world, it's hard to be thinking that we're going to be predicting a massive gain as a result of this.
So this leads a lot of different directions. I got like two I want to quickly follow up on, but one is about interurban inequality. So one way to understand work from home is that it expands the commuting range of people to roughly infinite. And one thing that we've thought for a long time is that commuting is one constraint on TBU sorting, Thibaut Sornick, sorry. And that one thing that this implies is that if this, however this goes, that we'll see is we're going to see greater concentrations in exclusively rich towns, because people can, if you can move anywhere, rich people will frequently move to live towards near one another and hoard property taxes, and they can have low tax rates and fancy schools and whatever else. And so do you think that an increase from work from home implies or should imply, say, greater school equalization efforts by states, state governments to equalize property taxes across jurisdictions or not?
So I agree strongly with the view that, you know, competition among places has just heated up. And, you know, the need to figure out policies that, you know, attract and retain the tax base seems really crucial to me at this point in time. I agree strongly that we certainly have a risk of increased enclaves of the rich, both within metropolitan areas and across metropolitan areas. I think, you know, we've seen increased sorting across metropolitan areas. We've certainly seen the emergence of extremely wealthy enclaves. I see no reason why that's not going to be embedded from work from home. Now, what the right policy response is, I am, I've spent 20 years on the fringe of the school reform movement. I, you know, am eager to see things work in the K-12 reform movement, but I think we need to be smart about this, and just equalizing money doesn't necessarily feel like the right thing for me. So I would, I guess, rather see, if we're going to engage in statewide taxes, I'd rather see, you know, things which are more innovative done with the cash rather than just giving to existing school districts. Like in the book, I mentioned this idea of experimenting with wraparound programs and vocational training that are after school and on the weekends and so on. So by all means, you know, we can go ahead and tax things, particularly tax immobile factors, right? We can tax the land, certainly. But let's try and make sure that money goes for things that we think will do most to promote opportunity, to promote upper mobility.
So I think Sam has a question about the education stuff that we'll come back to, but I want to quickly push on one more part of the work from home story, which is work from home can mean lots of things. And you talk about it in this book, but it can mean the two kind of classic, it's been like 35 seconds, but you know what I mean? The two things that people talk about in this sphere, one is fully remote, like you can live in Bali or whatever and still go to an office. Another one is coming to the office a little less often. And it seems to me these have pretty radically different implications for cities, because if people are coming to the office, they still have to live in the metropolitan area, whereas if they can live anywhere, they can not. When you're kind of predicting the future of cities, which is this book's called The Survival of Cities, what do you think the more likely path is, both hybrid versus kind of, you know, work, live anywhere stuff, and what implications do you think that has for cities?
Oh, I think the full remote is likely to be a very rare phenomenon, right? You're losing a lot if you're sort of never able to come in. And if you think about, you know, the sort of high-end tech-savvy people are the most likely to be full work from homers, as you noted, I mean, I have long believed that face-to-face contact and electronic contact are complements. I just cannot imagine that, like, our current Kendall Square in Greater Boston or Silicon Valley startup is now going to say, oh boy, you know what? You guys just go to a different suburban home somewhere and dial it in, and you know, we won't ever meet. Now, they could easily say, oh, you know what? This place is expensive and we want to pay lower taxes. Let's move to Austin, right? And we can connect with our venture capitalists over Zoom. We can connect with our previous investors over Zoom. That feels very plausible to me. Or we love skiing. We're all going to go to Vail. We love surfing. We're all going to go to Honolulu. All that feels plausible, but they're going to want to be together. And I think for many people, hybrid work is a real thing and will continue. But the full work from home thing, that seems like it's a very rare, probably for people who are like on the edge of retirement, that would seem like a particularly natural thing, that you're already thinking about detaching. And so you can do a little bit more of staying on. But it's not obvious that reduces the overall demand for offices, because you may well, decide that you're going to stay at the firm 5 years more because you now have the option to only going in two days a week. Right. So.
But shouldn't that lead to bigger cities? Because again,
you've lowered the commuting costs, and so you can go out further. Absolutely, David. Right. So it could well lead to a larger San Francisco metropolitan area rather than a smaller one.
And if offices shrink, then the same thing should be true. So that people are hot desking or whatever.
So
Sam, sorry, I didn't mean to keep going.
No, so I wanted to come back to kind of the race and inequality concerns that you raise in really interesting ways in chapter 9. You know, you note that the contrast between opulence and misery in cities goes all the way back to Plato, but this chapter is kind of obviously written in a post-George Floyd moment and registering kind of just the maybe some of the depths of of some of the inequality, and you acknowledge the need for institutional change in education and policing. There's a section on Ray Kelly, which I guess I didn't get it because it seemed to me to read as it kind of sympathetic, but acknowledging that he may have gone too far with stop and frisk. In the end, I guess my dominant impression, I really like to be corrected if it's wrong, is that you're kind of humble about whether anyone yet has ideas to face racialized inequality. You mentioned turning to community policing without defunding. You mentioned, you know, more movement, and as you said earlier in this combo, vocational education. And yet you're skeptical of kind of bigger plans for redistribution or outsiders, as you call them, demanding more perquisites. So it sort of seems at the level of kind of humble tweaks to see what might work. And is that accurate about where you are and what kind of possibilities you see for reform along all these dimensions?
Well, there are three questions, right? One of which is, you know, large scale redistribution at the national level. And I would say we just don't engage with it. I mean, I didn't see it as my job. I I don't think economists are very good at being on that, right? We don't actually know, you know, who's the right person to receive stuff. And so it's not our comparative advantage. Then there's schools. And I think, you know, you're exactly right. There's a lot of, I mean, in both policing and schools, what I tried to do was pair one sort of administrative story, Michelle Reed versus Ray Kelly, with one legislative story, the sort of race to the top versus three strikes and you're out, right? And the educational stuff tends to be, you know, very, I mean, I hope it comes off as humble. It's meant to come off as humble, right? It's meant to come off that, like, we're in a position in which we've got to do something to fix our schooling, and we're not exactly sure what works, which means we need to throw money at it and figure out how to do better on this. But it's not like I believe fervently in the need to do better to educate our disadvantaged children, but I don't believe that I'm sitting here with a silver bullet at all. So I have something that's helpful. In terms of police, it's interesting. You're right. I mean, my view of Ray Kelly is it's nuanced. And it's not, you know, I do think stop and frisk was a terrible policy. I'm not nuanced on that, but he was also doing exactly what voters wanted. So it's also a sense in which, you know, but part of the point of Ray Kelly was powerful. There is a reasonable track record of powerful, effective police chiefs who get done what their bosses, the mayor and the people want them to do. And hence we should be considerably more optimistic that if we give our police chiefs the right incentives, that they can actually make things happen. And so that's what I was trying to do with the Ray Kelly story. I wasn't trying to depict him either as a hero or a villain, but rather as an example of this sort of fact that there is, you know, there's something in the DNA of our police departments, which goes back to the Roman legions. And those, they follow their centurion, right? They follow their chief. The three strikes is a legislative situation. But again, unlike the case of the policing, the school reforms, you know, I actually think there's a, you know, we can reform three strikes tomorrow in terms of what we can do, and we can come up with better policies in terms of sentencing people. I did also tell the three strike story because I wanted to make people understand that basing policy based on outrage and anger rarely gets you to the right answer. And that was exactly what, you know, Ida Balaciotes was doing after the horrific death of her daughter, right? And, you know, she got to more locking up of bad sexual predators, which I think, you know, I certainly am fully on board on that one. And, you know, the guy who killed her daughter never should have been on the streets. But going from there to
taking
saying
a controversial position there, Ed, taking what? A controversial position.
And there I am. I am. That Gene Kane should not have been on the streets. But going from there to saying that every, you know, every three-time marijuana dealer should be locked up for life, that feels like that's a crazy thing. So it just seems like you want to be somewhat smarter about sentencing. And look, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a judge. I shouldn't be in the business of opining on what exactly the right sentencing should be. But clearly, we can do better than, you know, across the board, three strikes and you're out.
So I have a bunch of other kind of urban policy questions that this highlights. And so The book does a really nice job of laying out the huge gains made through urban health, public health initiatives in the mid-19th and early 20th centuries. We drained swamps, provided clean water, eliminated important urban disease in lots of ways. But this period also saw huge improvements in every other form of urban infrastructure, bridges, parks, libraries. All of our most beloved urban things, Central Park, Brooklyn Bridge, kind of date to this period. You've been involved in a project on infrastructure and building infrastructure in America. And one of the things that this research and kind of broader idea has shown is that the cost of building stuff in America has exploded. Alon Levy, Eric Goldwyn, Tracy Gordon, and me have shown that the cost of building subways in the U.S. is far higher and weirdly higher than anywhere else in the world, and that New York City is like bonkersly higher than that. Zach Liskow and Leah Brooks show that the cost of building highways has exploded. And they have some theories about why. It's great papers. Why do you think America is so bad at building infrastructure at a kind of a cost basis these days? Relatedly, do you think we could do any of the public health initiatives or the types of public health initiatives you suggest, given our like the fact that we can't successfully build three stops of a subway anymore?
It is unbelievable, and your work on the subways has been great, David. I mean, as was the Regional Plan Association had a nice sort of diagnosis of the sources of subway construction dysfunction. I think figuring out the sort of New York mess, I mean, your views are going to be as better informed than mine. It just feels enormously difficult. I mean, it just feels like there are 10 different ways in which you can squander, you know, millions to billions of dollars in this. And we seem to do all of them. And it just feels very, very hard to fix. There are simpler procurement things. So, you know, I just did this paper with Andre Schleifer, Simeon Jankov, and Erica Bozio on procurement practices around the world. And that's sort of interesting. I mean, you do get this pattern that in low efficacy states, you really do seem to need, things get better when you put a lot of restrictions on your procuring entity, when you give them a clear set of rules. In high efficacy environments like Singapore, basically you just tell the procurement agent to, you know, figure it out and, you know, do something smart. There is a sense in which New York certainly has rules that make it feel like it's a low efficacy entity. It's very restrictive on procurement, but I'm not totally sure that it's a high enough efficacy entity that it should have the low rules. So there's sort of both dimensions, which is to make sure you have the level of human capital and accountability in terms of the people running procurement, but also, you know, do you have the right level of rules that are surrounding them? Certainly Jeff Liebman, my colleague at the Kennedy School, who works with state level procurement entities, feels like, you know, for many of these states, less rules would be better. And they just have too many sort of holdovers of a past where you really had to fight corruption and you really do want to allow more flexibility to cut costs.
Does this make you skeptical of your kind of the variety of public health things you promote? I mean, so you promote some regulatory things and some other, but like, do you think that it's in fact beyond our capacity, or at least beyond our capacity to do so cost effectively, to do the kinds of things we did 100 years ago? So like all of the kind of heroic figures in your book like kind of created a capacity for government that, you know, may just not exist anymore.
I think we can do better than we're currently doing, David. I think we have a scope to improve. And I certainly believe, you know, I certainly have hope for sub-Saharan Africa, for India, for the places that actually do need to build sewers and basic infrastructure, in part because those technologies are fairly well understood. And, you know, institutions actually are getting better rather than worse. And so that's where I sort of, you know, I feel unequivocal about advocating, you know, a sewer building mission. It's harder for the U.S. And transportation certainly is an area in which we're much closer to diminishing returns in lots of areas than we were, you know, in sewers in the 19th century.
So that leads up really nicely to another question, which is about one thing the book doesn't spend a lot of time on is urban tech. So there's a lot of things about like Zoom and whatever in the book, but there's not a lot on either like Uber or alternately on like, I don't know, whatever Google Urban Sidewalk Labs is doing, like putting sensors everywhere and measuring everything, smart cities and all that jazz. To what extent do you think the survival of the city either depends on or will be frustrated by the development of urban tech, the things that the kind of techifying of the provision of urban services or urban transport or what have you?
So there's lots of scope for private innovation in this area. I think that will continue. How revolutionary it will be is unclear. The big things tend to run into the wall of public regulation. And certainly that's an issue for Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, where they're all in highly regulated sectors. And so their long run capacity to work change is going to be influenced by that. For urban tech that is essentially targeted at the public sector, which is true for many of those sensors, I am deeply skeptical. I mean, the public sector's ability to manage this stuff, to have personnel that, you know, work with this, you know, as we know, a tenured system tends to have a lot of people who are not really up on the latest technology. We know this from our own industry, right? And yet city governments tend to be just as tenured as university faculties are in a real sense. So it becomes very hard to have, you know, people who are actually going to be actively using, let alone thinking strategically about how they're going to, you know, input these things. So they get bought sometimes by city governments, but then they basically sit around and, you know, people revert to just taking notes on their old paper cards.
So we don't want to keep you. I have one last big kind of line of questions or big question for you, which is, as kind of a leading urban economist of our age, you reflected a lot on urban politics. Like, you're very critical of urban political machines. Your kind of famous paper on Mayor Curley in Boston, your discussion of Tweed in this book also. But you're also very critical of the thing that kind of replaced them, kind of left NIMBY politics in cities that challenged the machines, broke the machines, broke the growth machine. Your particular form of politics, kind of like silk stocking district Republican reformism, just isn't present basically anywhere in American cities these days. Maybe it should be. I share a great deal of it, but it's not as present. So in two of the cities that you know the best, we've kind of captured this in our recent election. So New York City is about to elect Eric Adams, which is going to be the closest thing to kind of a return to the machine, the candidate of both rich businessmen and big labor. And Boston looks like it's about to choose Michelle Wu, kind of a classic left NIMBY politician. If you had to choose, as the voters in these cities did and do, between neo-machine politics and neighborhood-driven left NIMBY politics, which do you think is preferable?
I think there's a lot to like about the less corrupt versions of the machines. I think that, you know, I mean, I have some very kind things to say in the book about Mayor Stephen Allen of New York, who, you know, was so responsible for the Broughton Aqueduct, who was a proud member of Tammany. Not, you know, far from the Tweed days of hyper-corruption, but still clearly part of the machine. Machines are long-lived. They often did a good job of taking care of the poorest residents of the city, taking care of bringing immigrants in the city. They have a lot to gain from the city's business moving. I think there's a lot to like about that. Now, obviously, you need, you know, checks and balances on that. And I think in some sense, the proudest role for the silk stockings was as the check on Tammany, right? They were supposed to be there to bring some discipline. So Teddy Roosevelt's out there, you know, championing good government in the face of Tammany. And that's great. And that sort of dynamic I like. Now, you won't have me say, I'm not going to say anything critical about Michelle Wu, who's a former student of mine and for whom I'm quite proud of her as a former student of mine. But I hope she sees the advantage of growth and change and making Boston a city for outsiders by allowing as much building as possible.
I did not mean to get you to crack on your former student. I apologize. I'll do all the cracking. It's fine. She's not my former student. The question though is that kind of leads to though is the kind of question that a lot of your book kind of dwells on, which is how we could think about structuring urban politics to avoid this, the dominance of urban insiders. And so I've kind of asked this in a couple of ways. And I just wanted to get some final reflections on, you have a lot of ideas here and they're very powerful and I think they're very convincing, but why do you think they will happen? Or do you think they will happen? I mean, you're very convincing. So, like, I, you know, more power to you. Like, I hope mayors listen to you.
It's a long game, David. So, you know, I've been arguing about promoting housing for, you know, 20 odd years. And, you know, I can't claim much credit for it, but now there is, you know, there's a YIMBY movement. There exist people who actually have views with which I share. And you know, it won a legislative success in California. And that's awesome. So, you know, we don't, It's not my job to argue for popular stuff, right? Politicians will always be there to argue for popular stuff. It's my job and yours, right, to argue for things that are not going to win us votes, but that can potentially change the way people think about things going forward. And I view the New York election as being a move towards the pragmatic center, that there were lots of options that would have gone away from this. And I think Adams is clearly in that pragmatic center, and there's a lot to like about that. So I think that the sort of larger point is that both in the health sphere and in the urban sphere, we need to actually stop asking, do we want more or less government? We need to start asking ourselves, how the heck are we going to get better government? Right. And we need to be judging our city leaders as managers. And we need to move away from anything which says, oh, this is going to be yet another ideological decision. I'm going to make this decision based on some form of ideological purity. I think we need measurement of things. And we think we need to be saying, are we holding the city to the standards in terms of, procurement costs and policing quality, police that both actually protects people and also delivers the kind of, neighborhood experience that people are asking for in schools. But in some sense, we're asking for a managerial revolution in both cities and healthcare. And obviously, it's a tall ask. But if we don't start asking, how are we going to get to it?
This is really terrific. Thank you so much, Ed. The book is Survival of the City. It's available at all fine bookstores. The link will be on the site. And thank you so much, Ed, for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.